Here we go. Okay. Welcome, everyone. I know people will probably trickle on still after we've gotten started, so please stop me if you need anything to be repeated. I will see some of you chatting and asking questions on the side, and I can just pause and try and address anything that seems really relevant. My name is Erin McCready. I'm from Oasis Youth Center in Tacoma, Washington, and we'll tell you more about who we are in a minute. Seth, do you want to introduce yourself? Hello. Well, Seth will catch up. We've had some technical difficulties on here, so hopefully he is here somewhere on the phone and that you guys can hear him. I've just moved to the agenda. So first we're going to talk about welcome and introductions, and we'll get a little bit more about who you are. I have a couple of poll questions that we've put together just so I can see who you guys work with, what's going on for you all, what you're looking to get out of this workshop, and move on from there. And then we'll talk about bystander intervention, what it is and who it's for. This is not a workshop that is going to teach you all of bystander intervention. Those trainings usually take 20 hours over several days. So if you came in hoping to learn what it is and be able to teach it, this is not the workshop for you. What we will do is talk about what it is, what the principles of it are, how we can modify it for the people that we work with, and that's the what about us portion. So when I was doing a lot of research around this bystander intervention and who I work with, I realized that it just really doesn't address any of the youth that I work with. So I modified it and really took time to figure out how it's going to work for the community that I serve. So we'll talk about how to do that, and then transforming and innovating tips and tricks. And then we'll have some answers and some questions and address what's going on for you guys. So can everyone hear me? Kat, have you seen any problems with that? We're good on that?
Nope. Looks like everything is coming through fine.
Great. And I don't know if I've lost Seth or not. But
I'm here, Erin. Sorry.
Oh, hi,
Seth. Everyone.
Okay. So, great. We are.
Yeah, my name is Seth Kirby, and I was on mute a few minutes ago, but I wanted to introduce myself as the director at Oasis. And as Erin mentioned, we are in Tacoma, Washington, and we are a drop-in resource and support center for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning youth ages 14 to 24. And our mission is to save lives, build community, and develop young leaders who can change the world. And we'll talk a little bit more about how we got to the place of doing bystander intervention training and the history behind that. But our parent organization is a local AIDS service organization, the Pierce County AIDS Foundation, and we've been in the community for about 27 years.
Right. Sorry, y'all. I'm learning how to use this stuff. Okay. So who I am is, my name is Erin McCready, and I work as the sexual assault prevention person at Oasis Youth Center. And again, we serve 14 to 24, so we have a lot of different age groups and different backgrounds coming to us. My job has been to develop some sort of curriculum that can really address youth's needs around sexual assault and prevention and what goes on in our community. Oasis serves about 450 youth a year. So we have a lot of different faces. We see some of them several times a week. We see some of them once every 6 months. We see some of them once in their lives. So we really try to address them at exactly where they're at, what they need, and so on. So our path to sexual assault prevention, Seth, do you want to address this at all?
Sure. Like I mentioned, we're part of the local AIDS service organization here in Tacoma, and since the beginning of our starting up about 27 or 28 years ago, part of our work really was around prevention. Mainly it was around HIV prevention, and that's part of the reason that Oasis started. And I think over time what we realized is that HIV prevention can also transfer over to other kinds of prevention, like sexual assault prevention, more broadly crime prevention, and other aspects related to youth empowerment, leadership development, and health and well-being. And about 6 years ago, I think really with the help of WICCAP and the Office of Crime Victims Advocacy here in Washington State, we began providing sexual assault prevention and community responding to the youth who come to OASIS. And Erin will talk more about how that has also gotten broader in scope by providing these trainings to youth not only just at OASIS but out in the community as well. I would say that one of the things that that WICCAP and OCDA really helped us with, I think in particular, is that because we're not a core sexual assault agency or organization, and that wasn't the core of our mission, though definitely related to our mission, we didn't necessarily have the formal training that it really takes, I think, to do this kind of work. And so part of what we hope today can bring is just passing on some of what we've learned about how to take all of the information and then filter it back down to something that works for your community.
Exactly. And I'd love to get, this is the part where I really want to get to know you a little, and I know this is hard with so many folks on the line, so I asked a couple of poll questions, so those are up, I believe, on your screen now. So if you could, this one's about what kind of organization or program you work with, and so that's statewide or national coalition, something like WICCAP, buy and form the marginalized community or group, and that is something like OASIS, who works specifically with LGBTQ youth. Any kind of grassroots organization would fit in that. An FADV Crime Victim Service Center, a funding organization, or something other than that. I just want to see where you all are at and what kind of audience we have here. Give you a minute to answer that question. Okay. And I see the majority here are in an FADV or Crime Victim Service Center. A lot of others. I'd love to know what I'm missing there, so if anyone wants to tell me at the end where they're specifically from. Okay. Sounds good. I'm going to change the slide, but we have a couple more questions.
So it looks like, Erin, some of our other answers, we had a couple people chat them in. Someone works at an intervention design and research evaluation firm, higher education, college prevention education, another university, a lot of universities actually, counseling and LGBT, center at a university, the military, and here in Seattle, the Northwest Network of Bi, Trans, Lesbian, and Gay Survivors of Abuse.
Perfect.
We have a really large college population on our call today, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah, which is, of course, I mean, that makes perfect sense when you're talking about bystander intervention, and we'll talk about that later, but that's really what most programs have been designed for, is college and university, and that's really what this is about, is how to take what people have already done so well in colleges and universities and create it for different folks that you work with, not just the football players or, you know, whoever is able to make it into a university. Okay, so this question, how many hours a week do you have access to your clients or participants? And this is just to get an idea of how in-depth you can really get with bystander intervention. Again, it is typically a longer and repetitive training. It's something that takes practice. So if you have 1 to 4 hours a week or you see someone once, that doesn't mean you can't implement some of these tools. You absolutely can, but it changes some of the ways that you would do that. And so I just wanted to see where people are at with that. We're open at OASIS 21 hours a week. 18 of those are regular drop-in hours. 3 of them are for a youth council, specifically for leaders here at OASIS. So that's a lot of hours a week that I get to spend with youth. It also is a challenge because, of course, you know, it's youth programming, it's voluntary, it's not in the school, so youth don't have to come here at any particular time. They don't have to come here the same time every week. So the challenges here are a little different than if you're a professor or, you know, if you're in a place where you see the same group every week. But I really get a lot of quality time, and I can create some quality programming in that. So it looks like the average we're looking at are somewhere between 5 and 20 hours. So most people get a good chunk. And we have a lot of people with the one-time educational session in there. And 1 to 4 hours a week, if you really get the same group, is still quite a bit of time to talk to people. So, okay, I'm going to go to the next question. How familiar are you with bystander intervention? So very familiar. You've been trained in it. You've spent some time really getting to know how to become a facilitator or how to intervene yourself. Comfortable explaining what it is, but not necessarily trained in that way. You've heard of it. You're not super familiar, or you've never heard of it. Give you a couple seconds to answer that as well. Okay. So most people have at the very least heard of it, and a lot of you are pretty familiar or trained to teach or at least perform some bystander intervention. I see that there's a few of you that haven't heard of it, so we will talk about the principles and what it is. Again, it won't be a teacher training or anything that in-depth. It really takes time, but what this is going to give you some resources, some free resources to learn more, some other ideas about how to learn about bystander intervention. Okay. So this, I really put this slide in here. This is the Peer Advocacy Mission Statement. So this is my program or one of the programs that OASIS has. And this is where the bystander intervention really takes place. When I started about 2.5 years ago, that's when I got to OASIS. They had done a lot of prep work for this. There was a ton of sexual assault prevention work that had already happened here. Youth were really familiar with consent. They were really familiar with some of the root causes of sexual assault. They were really clear about, you know, boundaries and how to ask if someone wants them to touch them or, you know, any of those things. But they hadn't really gone more in depth about how they can help their peers or, you know, interrupt an event or do anything like that. So when I got here, Seth really prepped me to take it to the next level and engage youth as leaders in the sexual assault prevention movement that was happening here. So OPEN already existed, and that's the OASIS Peer Education Network that you see there, and that's about a monthly meeting that happens here, and it can be a workshop. It could be about media literacy. It could be about really anything, and youth are often engaged and involved in that. That's sort of the larger group activity. And the Peer Advocate Program that we started is really more for specific people who want to step up and be leaders, and they want to know more. They're ready to learn, and we do a lot of, I wouldn't say vetting for that, but I think it's important to say that there is a prior process before someone's in a peer advocate program to make sure that they're ready to talk more in depth about sexual assault. That's a triggering topic. A lot of people have a lot of history, a lot of baggage that comes with that. And so we do a lot of checking in with youth about where they're at. We make sure that they feel really comfortable, that they aren't going to be set off in the middle. We talk about how to take care of themselves around that stuff. So we're not just opening it up to say, who wants to be a peer advocate? Come on in. Let's go, you know, which would be great. But I just think we recognize that our youth and the youth that I work with, they really have a lot of stuff going on around this. You know, there's been a lot of shaming. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of sexual assault history in everyone's sort of life, I'm sure. But we want to make sure that our youth are prepared and taken care of and know what they're getting themselves into. So they go through a sort of application process to get to become a peer advocate. So I'll just read this mission statement, even though you all can see it. But it's OPEN, OASIS Peer Education Network, empowers youth to become leaders and teachers in the LGBTQ community inside and outside of OASIS. We do this by educating, providing tools with which we can all take action, and providing the space for queer youth to use their personal assets to contribute to sexual assault prevention. So that's wordy, but youth really came up with that. And the reason I show it is this is how we kind of elicit buy-in in the first stages of creating a bystander intervention program for youth. When I get, I usually have about 4 to 8 youth who participate in this program. We do about 4 weeks of in-depth conversations, about 1 to 2 hours a week. And I'll show you the program and sort of, you'll get a curriculum as well after this is over in a handout. You'll see what each session consists of, how to create each session if you want to follow the same model. But in the first session, one of the main parts is coming up with this mission.
Hey, Erin.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you have your peers go through an application process. Someone had asked in the chat, how do you screen and check in with your youth? Do you have anything to add to about the application process that helps you find the right youth?
Sure. Right now I don't have a written standardized application, and I've talked a lot about doing that, so I am coming up with some sort of pre-qualifiers just to get youth really bought in as well, to say that they've applied, they want to become a peer advocate. We can look through and really screen where they're at. But what I've done so far is really get to know each youth. So it's 4 to 8 youth at a time. I usually target, like, I see leaders, I see youth stepping up. I know a little bit about them. And so I get to address them in a personal way, just to say, hey, are you interested in this? And then if people are interested, and some youth have come to me and said, I want to do that, and I don't necessarily know that they're ready to do that. So we'll talk one-on-one is what I've done. And we talk about, what do you know about sexual assault prevention? What's your experience? And often I've found that youth that really want to learn more, they have specific reasons why. You know, they have a history. If it's not for them, it's their family members, or they've seen something happen. So it's really personal generally when I find youth that want to do this. And so we talk about, well, what has your healing process been around that? Have you been to therapy? And if not, we do have therapy vouchers. Have you talked to people about it? How long ago is this? What is your coping methods now? You know, so we do a little bit of a check-in about where they're at in their process. And if we feel reasonably sure that it's like, yeah, I have really processed this, of course this still comes up for me. Or I haven't really, but I really want to, you know, I'm really ready to do that. Then we help them in that process. We'll do like some prep work. It'll be like, okay, so how about we give you 4 sessions with a therapist and help you get to a place and check in again and say the next round in 2 or 3 months, let's go through this. Scott, do you have anything to add about that? Because I know you've done a lot of that as well here.
Yeah, I think, you know, the other piece that we're looking for is, I think our model at OASIS really is to believe that every youth has leadership abilities and capacity when they walk in the door the first time when they visit OASIS. And also that we want to know that youth have had some sort of prior leadership work probably before doing this. And that might be something in their school or their church or their job or something else at OASIS. And if they haven't, then it's an opportunity to kind of help them figure out how to plug in as a leader. And then also I think the second piece is really to talk with youth about how this isn't a support, what open is and what it isn't. So
mm-hmm.
It's not really a support group. It can be healing for people, but it's not, it's not a support group, and we don't offer support groups, and we're not therapists. And so we are really clear with youth from the beginning about what it is and what it isn't. And also other youth talk with prospective youth about it. And so those are some of the ways that we have individualized the process for youth as they start to join. And like Erin said, I think now that we are at this place, we can start to formalize that process a little bit more, but we
mm-hmm.
do want to keep it flexible so that we can specifically engage each youth who wants to join and then follow
mm-hmm.
up with them and say, hey, you know, 3 months ago didn't feel like the right time, but how are you now and where are things at now, and do you feel like this might be a good next step? And so we've engaged lots of youth over time in that way. And because youth can come to OASIS for such a wide age range, 14 to 24, it is really neat that we have 14-year-olds who are part of this and we have 24-year-olds who are part of it. We have people who are in the military who are stationed nearby, at a base nearby, who are part of this. We have freshmen in high school who are part of this, and we have college students who are part of it. So we have kind of everybody in between, but it is an opportunity to really make sure that that group can gel and that people understand what open is and what it isn't.
Right. Does that answer? I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, our participant chatted back in and said thanks for answering her question. That was a great answer, Seth and Erin.
Okay. So what is bystander intervention? So I'm going to break this down very simply. There's a couple of slides that sort of have the 1, 2, 3. And what it is much more complicated. It's very simple, and it takes a lot of practice. I won't say that it's complicated. I do not believe that bystander intervention is complicated. But I do think that it really challenges people to step up in a way that is not necessarily comfortable for them, and that is not something that happens overnight. So I took these steps from stepup.org, and that's a free website, and I will send out the link to that. That's in your handouts as well that are going to come to you after this is done. But it is a really helpful guide. It has facilitators training with recorded hours of training. There's a lot of programs out there, and some of them are phenomenal, and some of them cost a lot of money. So I haven't specifically plugged a lot of those. That doesn't mean they're not amazing or fantastic. There's a lot of really great programs out there. But this is the free resource. So if you're coming from a nonprofit, which I'm assuming a lot of us are, it's helpful to be able to just reference this and listen to some of the facilitators' guides. So bystander intervention is a process in which a person first notices an event happening. He just sees something going on that could potentially be dangerous. And this can go from harassment and bullying to name-calling to a potential rape situation to, you know, really anything that's going on. It could be domestic violence. It could be anything that's happening, but it's really about noticing something happening. And there's a lot of steps to actually noticing something happening, which is, you know, when you go through a bystander training. And if you go to this website, it's helpful just to see, they kind of have, like, what blocks someone from each step, what's challenging about each step, and what can help someone get through each step. So noticing an event, there's obviously a lot of reasons why we won't notice an event happening. It could be that we don't believe it's happening. It could be that we can't tell and we don't trust ourselves that we think it's happening. There's a lot of things happening in that one step. The next thing is that you interpret the event as a problem. So you see it happening and then you say, no, I really think that's not okay. Whatever is going on there feels wrong to me. And then assuming responsibility is the next place in this, which is really just saying, okay, if I see something happening that I think is wrong, it's my job to do something about it. The next step is having the skills to actually intervene. So it's one thing to say, I see something happening and I think I should do something about it. But if your best tool is to then go to the middle of this very dangerous situation and start a fight, then maybe that's not the best skill to intervene. So in this step, this is really where we spend a lot of time practicing skills to intervene, talking about different ways to intervene, you know, what the best methods are, and we'll talk more about that. And then the fifth and final step would be taking whatever action it is that you decide is the right one. And this is just another, this is from stepup.org, and this is just sort of a cheesy acronym, but it's really helpful for me, and it's really helpful for the youth that I serve. It's just C, safe, early, effective. So this is the goal. When I'm teaching this to youth, it's really trying, a lot of the youth I work with, so I'll just use this as an example, they might be used to intervening, but it's not always very safely, for instance. You know what I mean? I have a youth that, and I'll talk more about this, that really is like, yeah, I'll intervene. I'll end up in a cop car, you know, at the end of intervening, but I'll intervene. And that's his natural, you know, that's what he knows. That's what he knows how to do. And so really talking about, like, is that helpful? You know, is that a great intervention method if it's very unsafe to you, if you're potentially in danger, if you're potentially arrested, if, you know, whatever is going on for you ends up much, much worse than the potential situation that was just happening, or that you now are the victim of the crime that was about to occur instead of, you know, just an intervener in a crime. So we talk a lot about safe, early, and effective, and the principle being that if it's early, it's safer, right? Before something escalates to a place that's really dangerous, it's going to be a lot safer. And effective is important for the youth that I work with, just to really think about, is this helping the person that you're intervening for, or is this coming from a place that's really full of, like, rage or revenge or, you know, any of those things, talking about how does it actually help the person that you're intervening for. Is there any specific questions about that side, or Seth, do you have anything you want to add?
Well, while we wait for questions, if any come in, I think in terms of working with youth, it's really helpful to also talk through those steps about what bystander intervention is and what safe, early, and effective looks like for your community. So if that's the military, or if that's college students or on a college campus, or that's in a different kind of a setting than we've talked about today, it's just really important, I think, to kind of go through with your group of peer leaders and kind of establish what bystander intervention looks like and what safe, early, and effective looks and feels like, both for the bystander as well as, you know, potentially the person who is experiencing violence, the person who is engaging in violence, the perpetrator, so that people can start to think about what safe, early, and effective looks like from their perspective, but then also from, like Erin said, everybody else's perspective of who's involved.
Right. Yeah, and that's something, so in the next few slides, we're going to talk a little bit about how to make it your own and how to really cater your bystander intervention program to the youth that you serve. Typically, for those who haven't done a lot of research about bystander intervention or haven't taken a trainer or trained the trainer training or whatever, there's the programs I've been to, and I've researched a few and I've gotten to be in a few trainings, and they're really inspiring, and they're really about, like, kind of igniting the leader in each one of us, whoever, you know, whatever that is. What are you able to do? What is the thing that's going to make a change or make something happen as an effect of your actions? And that could be a very little something or a very big something. And what I found challenging, and what this is really about, is that I haven't found anything for anyone other than, like, really something geared towards college students or students in general. A lot of the youth that I work with are not students, or they have dropped out, or they've been kicked out, or they are living on the streets in various ways, or they're couch surfing, or, you know, whatever's happening for them. And they really need this information. You know, it's something that, when we've talked about it and when we go through it with them, they're, like, really thinking about how to implement these things in their lives. And if it was presented to them in the way that even Step Up, the Step Up program, which I think is a great tool, if I handed that over to one of my youth, I think they would look at me like I was crazy. You know, it's just really geared towards football players, you know, and which is great and really necessary. It makes complete sense. But they would look at even the website and think about, how is this related to me, you know? So adapting some of these things and catering it to who I'm actually working with, I think, is really important, which is what programs have done for leaders like football players. You know, it makes perfect sense that it's really specific to specific groups. I just hadn't found anything specific to my group. I hope that makes sense. Okay. So, and that's the what about us. So challenges and opportunities for marginalized communities. this is when I came and started doing this work. And while researching the principles of bystander intervention, I got to wondering how any of youth that I work with will really learn the skills and the principles if they don't see themselves represented really clearly. So normally at this point, I would really have an open discussion about some of the roadblocks that marginalized communities face. And I don't love the word marginalized, by the way, but it's just the sort of shorthand to what I'm talking about. So, you know, gangs, homelessness, lack of educational resources, some of the things that come up for youth all across America and all different groups and communities. This is what I started brainstorming. What are the challenges? What if you can't read? You know, what if you don't have a place to sleep? How do you really, like, take this stuff in and make it yours?
And, Erin, I was going to just throw out on that that last slide, too. I think, you know, it's what our youth tell us is that they are able to take what they learn and apply it at work, at school, but also at places like a shelter that is traditionally, at least in our community, not a safe place for an LGBT youth or young adult. But because of that acronym of safe, early, and effective, just something that sticks in their mind. And Erin's going to talk about some tips later on about little wallet cards and things like that. But those are the kind of things that have allowed youth to apply what they know in places where it's really scary for them to apply what they know. And when we talk about the impact of not having a specific training for the LGBT community, it comes up a lot at OASIS. When we talk about hate violence, there's not a way to talk with youth about hate violence without also talking about sexual violence. Because many youth either have experienced hate-motivated violence based on their sexual orientation or gender identity, and subsequently sexual violence, or they're afraid that's what they will experience. And so whatever community it is that you're working with, really thinking with that group of leaders about why is it important to have something specific to your community that's by and for your community and that's led by leaders in your community.
Right. Yeah. All good points. And that's what I think. I mean, exactly what Seth is talking about, and I'll move on from this in a second, but that was the part that I got really stumped about when I got here. You know, I got here and it was like, okay, great, let's talk about how to intervene, let's talk about how to help your peers. And what my youth talked to me about was really different than any of the things I was seeing or hearing or the trainings I was getting. It was just very specific. And I saw some questions about how you inspire people, and we'll get to that later, but I think being really, really specific to who my audience is, and that means that if I have six youth who are different than the six youth I had in the last group, we really talk about who they are prior, and we talk about what they want to get out of this training in that first session. I think a lot of what I do is working on buy-in. A lot of what I do is working on, getting people really invested. So if they have a specific scenario, and Seth mentioned the shelter scenario, and that is a common one, unfortunately, at OASIS, that we really talked about, so what do we do in that situation? So what do we do when we're in a shelter and see A, B, and C, or experience A, B, and C, or, you know, how do we avoid it? How do we intervene? How do we elicit other people to intervene on our sake, you know, on our behalf? That sort of thing. So it gets really specific about who I'm talking to, and I think that that's really, really important. Okay, so this is an example of an activity for youth. And normally if I do this live, if we were in a room together, we would all actually break into small groups and we would brainstorm and write down a realistic scenario of sexual violence in our community or with the people that we serve. And this is something that I do with youth. So I think it's the second session, and you'll get all of that. But at some point during this training, we really break into groups and we talk about what is realistic for us what is something either we've seen someone experience or something that we've experienced, and then we brainstorm different ways to intervene. And so I have written down there one direct and two indirect way to intervene, and we try to come up with one of each. And what that means is direct being that I actually might walk up to someone and say, hey, it looks like you're having a hard time. Do you want to go somewhere with me? Do you need a break or, you know, back off or, you know, whatever that is. And an indirect way of being like, I might call the cops. I might, you know, I might ask the bartender to intervene. I might get friends to intervene. I might do something like that. So there's different ways to do that. And I'll share a couple of scenarios with you all. And I think this is a good place to share it. So when we've broken into groups, I've had a lot of different scenarios come up, but here's a couple, some sort of common ones that have come up. I had a youth in the first session I did with this, and I've heard it several times since that, then say he identifies as a transgender male, and he likes to go to bars with his friends. And several times, on several occasions, he's gone out with his friends, and he's drinking, and it's often women, which I find interesting, that find out that he is trans or he expresses that he's trans. He talks about who he is or his identity, and they think it's their right to investigate that further by grabbing his chest. So this is a common thing. He said this happens all the time, where they'll just say, oh, really? And they want to see if he's had top surgery or not or where he's at in his transition, and they think that it's okay for them to grab him. So this is an assault that he experiences regularly. He at the time expressed that he was still pretty upset about it. He's experienced worse things in his life. He didn't consider it to be the worst thing that ever happened to him, but really disturbing, not okay, felt really violating, was not consensual, you know, any of those things. And so we've used this scenario, and we're creating a book of scenarios here at Oasis, and people brainstorm different ways to intervene. So direct, and this is assuming you're the bystander. So you're the friend of this friend, and he has many friends that go to Oasis and have taken a lot of these trainings. So, you know, we've talked about how do you actually intervene in that situation. So directly just saying, hey, that's not okay, can you back off? Indirectly having someone distract her or buy her a drink, or, you know, there's different ways to do this. But really at that point, the assault's already taken place, and a lot of times it's about how to prevent it from happening again. So we talk a lot about different ways to talk to someone about that, different ways to express, you know, how you feel around that. Seth, do you have anything to add to that scenario before I move on to the next scenario?
I think this is another place where it does allow a really neat conversation to happen between people who are really committing and going through this peer leader training together. And kind of, I mean, we have a community, the LGBT youth community, but people's experiences are very different. We serve an incredibly diverse group of youth, whether that's based on, like Aaron said, race or ethnicity or geography or gender identity, military affiliation, and so forth. And so this allows people to really start hearing a little bit about what might happen to somebody who has a different identity than them or what they've, you know, seen or experienced. And that's a great way to, you know, with some parameters and good facilitation, really start talking about what could be different next time, or how could people, like Aaron said, intervene in a way that, you know, either makes a scene or doesn't, but the end result is preventing this from occurring again.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, the next scenario I'll talk about, and this is just to give sort of examples of where people are at. So this scenario came up when we did our first big group training. So one thing, we'll go through this more in depth with several youth, and then we'll have those youth teach it to their peers. So we did one larger training, and it was probably, I don't know, 20 to 30 youth in the room. And each of the peer advocates who had gone through this took a part of the training and just really talked about the principles, talked about the steps, and talked about the challenges to each step, and then talked about some scenarios. And it's a very general overview to use. It doesn't mean that they're prepared to go out and intervene in any situation, but it gives them a good foundation, and it gives them an idea of what the peer advocate program is about and if they want to join and if they want to know more and, you know, all of those things. So one of the scenarios that came up when we were doing this training, and I think it was a good learning experience for me, because, you know, we do it and we're really excited about, you know, and then you just you see something happening and how do you intervene? And thinking, you know, everybody's going to be really into this. My youth are really advanced in my mind. You know, they're really amazing and they're going to be really excited to learn how to stop something from happening to someone else. And one of the youth kind of wasn't feeling it. And he said, you know, somebody intervened while I was fighting with my boyfriend on the street, and he was implying physically, because apparently that happens sometimes, I would beat them up. You know, I would really, and he said worse things than that, you know, but he was like, I would put them down. And if you guys got in between me and him in the middle of a fight, and if he deserved it, like this is my, you know, one of the youth talking, then everybody would go down. You know, that's just what would happen. And we couldn't get him on board, you know, we just couldn't, we could not, and of course this is a bigger issue, right? Like this is something that needs to be addressed more in depth. This is obviously, he's not even seeing that physical violence is not the answer, you know, any of those things. It was the answer for him. It's what he knows. He said, you know, if you're in my neighborhood and you do that, then this is what's going to happen to you. I'm like, fair, you know, fair enough. That's true for you. So I really got to talk with that youth and go through this again with him and say, okay, what would work? You know, what would work? So in your neighborhood, in that situation, what would actually stop you from being in a physical fight with your boyfriend? And at first he was, you know, like nothing. If I was sure that this is what needed to happen, that's what would happen. And I said, well, what if someone, you know, called the cops? And he said, okay, that would stop it for then, you know. What's the fault you really need? He's like, I guess it would stop it, but if I knew who did that, or if I could figure out who did that, or if you were the only, you know, if you were the obvious suspect in that, then that would still go down badly for you. I said, okay, what are other ways? And so he came up with really creative, funny ways that would actually distract him, you know, like take him away from the moment. And this was a while ago, and I have this all written down somewhere, but it was funny things. It was like, what if you acted drunk and fell on him? You know, what if you bumped into him and just distracted him from where he was at? What if his, you know, his boyfriend's mom came walking down the street at the same time? Or, you know, there was just lots of different ways that he came up with that were creative that would have actually interrupted that event. And it would only interrupt that event for that minute, you know. But then we talked more about, okay, once that was interrupted, what could actually calm you down? So let's say you were distracted. What would actually distract you enough or take you, kind of cool you off enough that you could have a conversation, that someone could come up to you and say, hey, what's going on? You know, this doesn't seem like it's working for you. This doesn't seem like it's helping you or him. It seems like you guys need a break. And he came up with great ideas about, okay, well, if I was already distracted, you know, if it was already interrupted, here's some things people could say to me that might actually calm me down or take me away or pause me enough to change the situation, you know, to not have that event take place, at least for that moment. And that's a huge thing. I feel like that for me was a really huge eye-opener, because it was his experience, it was real life, and it was his neighborhood, and it was his sexual orientation. And he got to really think about, like, what would do anything for me? And then all the youth, like Seth said, this was really a learning experience, not just for him, but for all the youth in the room. Because the youth who are doing the training, you know, they're stoked about it. And what I heard from them was, well, that's not okay. It's not okay for you to say that you couldn't be intervened on. You know, you have to acknowledge you're here, you're at Oasis. You have to say that it's bad to be in a physical fight with your boyfriend, or else you're not doing it right. And we got to pause that and say, no, this is real. You know what I mean? This is actually his experience. And sees where he's at and is being honest about it. So how would you intervene in this situation that's really specific and different than what you've assumed people would want? You know, like assuming people actually want to be interrupted in the middle of an event like this is really not realistic. So it was great. It was a great learning experience, and it all came from doing this activity and really talking about specific scenarios that are true for us. Is there any questions or anything you want to add, Seth? Any questions that are specific to this?
No, I think that's great. I guess another brief story I'll add is a youth who came out, and his dream job was to work at a bikini barista stand. And he didn't have any family support, and we talked with him about his employment options. He was either going to work at a tanning salon or a bikini barista stand and be the one guy working at this bikini barista stand. And over time, he became involved in this program and started participating. And like the other person Aaron was describing, really started to, I think, see his experience in a different way, and to start thinking about how he could make some different decisions or walk down a different path later on in his life by intervening when he saw something, and also by asking people to intervene on his behalf. And that's something that he had never experienced, as he hadn't experienced people standing up for him at school, which is why he dropped out of school. He hadn't experienced care and concern from his parents when he came out. He got kicked out of the house. And so this was an opportunity for him to start really expecting from the community that people would stand up for him, that they would support him, and that he didn't have to go through this, and that he didn't have to go through it alone.
Right. Yeah. And I do see a specific question on the side, too, saying you're wondering how this was addressed from the perspective of the person committing battery, because it is an illegal behavior, obviously. Well, at the time, so this all came up in the brainstorming scenarios, and he was very much talking about a hypothetical situation. Of course, I have no doubt that he's experienced a lot of violence in his life and that is his tool for dealing with a lot of things, or at least it was. This was a few years ago almost now, and I would say that youth, I don't even see a lot of those behaviors exhibited now. But at the time, I mean, how it was addressed with him is that he was the next recruitment for me with bystander intervention. That's how it was dealt with from our perspective. We talked in depth about a lot of things with that youth, and we still do. And I have no idea if he's experiencing violence in his life today, as of today. He has not indicated that, and I don't see that on him. But he is a college student now. He had dropped out of school. There's a lot going on for him. But at the time, it was really addressed of just saying, well, how can we interrupt that event? What's going to actually change this behavior for you? I didn't shame him at that time. I didn't, you know, I certainly didn't mention cops or illegal behavior. I don't think he would have ever come back in that session. But he wasn't talking about a specific situation that I knew of that I could actually take any action on at the time. Does that answer the question? I hope.
I think, Aaron, this is Seth. I think the one other piece I'll add is that I think what Aaron really illustrated in that example was how part of our role in this is to really meet people where they're at, and meet people where they're at by also including their experience and accepting their experience, and telling them that because of their experience, they actually have assets that they could bring forward to future situations that either they or someone else might encounter, and that all ideas are worth, you know, Aaron created a space where all ideas could be put on the table. And because of that, you did put them on the table and talked about it. And like we discussed earlier, some of those, you know, conversations, people might go through the list and say, well, it was safe. You know, I don't know if it was safe. It was early. It may have been effective, but it may not have been actually safe. And so kind of going back to that and using that double check in the different options that people come up with, and also recognizing that there are some youth who may not be able to, for example, call on someone else to help them or contact the police or use an outside influence, like Erin said. And right. So I think because of this training and this program that he's gone through, though, this particular youth, like Erin said, is in college. He's definitely a leader at OASIS among 450 youth and is showing up again and again and not engaging in violence, because if he was, he wouldn't be able to be at OASIS. And right. So he's continuing to demonstrate his capacity to care for other people and is actually modeling that now much more fully for other youth.
Yeah, I mean, I'll also just add to that this, I think what I saw in him that day where he was just really irritated that the scenarios weren't reflecting his experience. You know, so we did this training, and I naively was like, all the OASIS youth are going to be really excited to find out how to do this. and he, what he heard was scenarios that he didn't see happen in his neighborhood, you know, or he heard of interventions that he was like, you wouldn't be able to get away with that where I came from. And I know this youth pretty well now, and I didn't at the time. I have never heard of him actually using violence. I've heard of him in situations where violence is really prevalent. And I think that he just felt like, well, what about me, you know? And what would you do in my neighborhood? Because this doesn't sound like it would help me. And so that's what I heard the most out of that. And that's what we really talked about. And like Seth said, he's been really engaged in one way or another in OASIS ever since. And he is a leader, and he has a lot to give and a lot to add. His strengths are that he knows what it's like to try to change something and see it not work, and that he can really bring to the situation new ideas and creative ideas. And I value him, and I think that OASIS really values him. So we can talk more about this stuff at the end too, but I just want to get moving on to steps to making your own program. And this is really what this is about. So, again, this is not an all-inclusive bystander intervention program that we're teaching you today at all, by any means. But what it is talking about how you can create something that's relevant to the people that you work with. So the first step in this, and this is definitely more Seth's strong suit than mine, is conducting a needs assessment. So what people know and what do they want to know. And this is there's lots of ways to do this. And we've included in your handouts some resources to doing this as well, some sites to go to look for different ways to create needs assessment. Seth, do you want to speak to this a bit, and then I can add?
Yeah, I think what we found over time was that, you know, starting 6 years ago, we really had to start talking with youth just about what does consent mean? What does that mean? What does that look like? We often talk about some of the root cause issues of sexual violence in our community and discuss everything from kind of societal homophobia to internalized homophobia. This is the way that a man is supposed to behave, or this is the way that a woman is supposed to behave, looking at gender stereotypes. And all of that really led to having more conversations with youth about what is sexual violence anyway. And I think what was true is that probably 6 years ago, many youth who were experiencing sexual violence didn't have a name for it. They didn't know, they weren't able to verbalize that that's what it is that they were experiencing or that they had seen. And I think today youth are able to identify that much more readily, either in their own life or in talking with us about a concern that they might have about a close friend or someone that they're connected with. By connecting a needs assessment, you know, really, whether that's through some focus groups or surveys, et cetera, asking people what do they want to learn, what do they feel like they need to learn, and then also getting some statistics and information about sexual violence that's specific to your community. So we really looked at that as Pierce County, Washington, youth, LGBTQ youth, youth of color, and really breaking down some of the different groups that we have at OASIS, and then also talking about underreporting of crimes and how those are just examples and that statistics are just one piece of the story. But that, for our group, they often don't see their experiences reflected in that information, so it was important for us to start with some of those pieces as well.
Are there any questions about the needs assessment, specifically that piece? I really think it's an evolving thing as well. I think I'll add that in the last 2.5 years, the needs of the youth that are new to OASIS in the last, you know, they've done intakes in the last 6 months, might be really different to the same, you know, the same youth that I did this program with 2 years ago. So constantly checking in and really knowing my audience. And again, I feel like for me, that level of specificity, like really sitting with, if it's six people that are going through this, really knowing who they are and knowing a tiny bit about where they come from and what they want to learn is really important. It's going to change how I teach this. It's going to change which scenarios we talk about. Knowing where people are at as far as triggers go, knowing all of that, it's going to really affect some of the language we use. And like Seth said, a lot of youth, especially a couple years ago, but I'd say in waves of new youth as well, won't know that sexual violence has even occurred, or that, you know, it's just such a, some scenarios are very common and they aren't necessarily recognizing that that's sexual assault. So we spend a whole session talking about what sexual assault is and coming up with a shared understanding of what it is, getting a definition that works for the group, and not me telling them this is sexual assault. So when they can identify something for them, that's like, well, that happens to me all the time. I'm not sitting there telling them that they're being sexually assaulted all the time. I want them, if that's true, I want them to come to that conclusion on their own, if that makes sense. You know, I really want them to be the peer leaders and talking, and I'm there to facilitate and support and guide and do all of that. But I want people to feel as much that they are coming to conclusions themselves instead of me telling them what's true and false about their experience. I hope that makes sense. And I do see do you have a sample of the questions asked in the needs assessment or the survey itself? There's a link that is going to be on the handout that you get that will take you to different ways to do needs assessments. So I won't get into that right now. I don't have that in front of me. But there will be resources for you for that. Okay. So step two, gather relevant statistics and information about sexual violence and assault in your community. So this is really hard if you're working in marginalized communities. And I think, like Seth said, in any community, the underreporting and all of that statistics are not necessarily readily available. They are not necessarily accurate. It's really hard to say what's true and false. So I did personally a lot of research and found very little that I thought was incredibly useful. But I did actually take one of the best things I took was a webinar through WICSAP, I believe, put on by, and Kat, you can help me out, but it was folks in Wisconsin. So it's going to take me a minute to remember what that was. Forge, I think it was called Forge. And they had some national surveys, and they really worked with youth and LGBT, specifically trans youth, to gather statistics and do a lot of work in that field. So I got some real information that was really helpful, that when I talked to youth about it, they could really hear that it was true. And we could talk about some of the major themes and issues in our community. So I spent probably, I don't know, Seth, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think 2 or 3 months researching sexual violence in our community. And that meant sitting down with youth and getting an idea of their experiences, doing webinars, reading articles, getting books, really just trying to see what are the themes, what's true. Because I was once an LGBTQ youth, you know, but that was a while ago. And I was in Chicago. You know, it's really as specific as, like, what's happening in the Northwest, what's happening in Tacoma, what's happening in Pierce County, what's true for queer youth here. Some of the themes that I found was overwhelmingly street youth. The numbers of street youth that identify as LGBTQ are huge and disproportionate to the number of youth that are actually experiencing homelessness. So a lot of the work that I did and a lot of the statistics and scenarios that I got to bring to the group and talk about in this program was what it's like experiencing homelessness and what are some of the potential sexual violence situations that can happen on the streets or in shelters, you know, all of those things. So that was one theme that I really found. We talked about professionals, you know, police or law enforcement professionals and the numbers of youth and trans youth specifically that identify having been assaulted by law enforcement, by doctors, some of the tactics of power and control in our community, and that could be the threat of being outed and using that as manipulation to get what someone wants in a either sexual or otherwise kind of way. We talked about survival sex, which a lot of our youth experience, which is, you know, just trading sex for a place to live or stay. And that, I found that a lot of youth really found that that was a place where they at least got to choose what was happening to them, even though it was not a choice they wanted to make. So we talk a lot about those scenarios, how to help our friends or our peers in those situations, how to talk with them in a way that is not judging or offensive, you know, how to support people that we're all friends with here, you know, that we all care about. So those were some of the things that came up for me, and I really recommend whoever you work with and wherever you are in your process, that's like the place to start, is really to look at who you serve and what's going on in that community. Seth, do you have anything to add to that?
I think the only other piece is that the needs assessment that you do up front, and then the next step in part two about getting the statistics, more in-depth information about your community in particular, is really helpful, and that you can really start tying those two pieces together. And it's important to keep going back to the group of people that have shown interest in this program to kind of let them know where you're at, or ask them if, you know, for our youth, we have lots of youth who have school projects or have a one-month internship. And so depending on, you know, who that person is, it might be a good fit for them to help volunteer or work on doing some of this information gathering with you, which just goes to help create more buy-in, like Erin was talking about earlier.
Yeah, and this is really about, so, I'll go to the next slide and then we'll talk about all of these things. So this is about, step three is research other bystander programs. So what can you borrow or adapt? Step up is the one I keep referencing just because it's really straightforward and free and adaptable. So it's something that I can get online regularly, so I can go and review before I meet with you if there's something I'm having trouble explaining or feeling stuck on. I can re-listen, I can reread. It's easily accessible. But what this whole thing is about is really how to take something that is geared towards one group of people and make it specific to who you work with. So one bystander intervention program is called MVP. It's Mentors in Violence Prevention. And this kind of goes back to talking about the scenarios that my youth came up with earlier. That program is geared towards athletes, college athletes generally. I think there's a high school one now too. But it was created because they saw a lot of patterns of power and control and sexual violence and harassment and bullying in the athletic community in school. So this man, Jack and Katz, he created this program called Mentors in Violence Prevention, and it was calling athletes and football players and basketball players out as the leaders in their communities and making them feel responsible for what happens, what their friends do, what their teammates do, what their peers do. And if you know better and you let your teammate, you know, call women hoes or whatever it is, then you're giving them permission and you are a part of this. You're a part of this culture. You're a part of the violence that's being created. And so it's treating them as if they would never be the ones committing the assault. And they are a leader, and so they can prevent other people from committing it. So that's sort of the principle behind it, is that I'm going to get leaders, and then I'm going to tell them, we know you would never do this, essentially, but it's happening a lot around you. And because people look up to you and care about what you think, we're asking you to not only not engage in the behavior, but call people out when they engage in the behavior and make it uncool to do. You know, so that's sort of the principle behind it. I think that's what's genius about it, you know, because it's non-confrontational. People can hear it. People feel like they have something to do about it. And so with my youth, I'm taking, you know, I've researched MVP. I have some of their playbooks. That's what they call them. And that's their scenario books. They have, and you can buy them online, Mentors in Violence Prevention. You can buy their scenario books online, and I've studied them. Very few of the scenarios are super relevant to the youth that I work with. There's not many of them that I've taken directly from the book and said, here's a scenario, you know. But I've given them to youth and said, hey, will you look through this and come up with five scenarios and ways to intervene in those scenarios that you think are relevant to you or to people that you're friends with or, you know, to our community. And they've taken them home, they've studied them, they've come back with ideas and scenarios. We've done lots of brainstorm sessions. We've all written things down and put them in the middle of the room so no one knew where they came from, and we could take one and read it and brainstorm ideas of how to intervene. So those are some of the activities we've done. And it really came from, you know, there's tons of research behind these bystander intervention programs. Green Dot is one that's amazing, and I think I saw some folks on this webinar that teach Green Dot and do a great job with that program, and that's towards college students. That one is broader than MVP. It's not just towards football or, you know, basketball stars or, you know, athletic teams. It's towards any student that's available and wanting to learn, and it's a great program. But what I do is try and take some of those principles and those ideas and bring them to my youth and say, hey, does this feel relevant to you? Do you mind reading through this? And they become really responsible for creating their own bystander intervention program. And the buy-in that I get from that seems really huge. You know, if I have 6, 12, 18, 24 leaders here that have taken the time to read through all of these scenarios and programs that other people do and brainstorm things that are relevant to them, and then talk about ways to intervene that's relevant to who they are and what they're capable of doing with their own experiences and personality types, I just see a huge return in that. You know, I get the feeling that, you know, there's youth that are really changed for the better with this program, and that they see themselves in it, and that they can visualize themselves in situations where they get to make a difference. And that's huge. You know, that's huge in creating leaders. It's huge in creating confidence. It's huge in creating the ability to step up where they never thought they could before. So I don't know. Seth, do you have anything you want to add to that?
No, I think that covers it. We should just kind of been looking at the time. We should probably look at the video and then answer some questions.
All right. Okay. So we're about to show you a video. These are two Oasis peer advocates. This is something I took very quickly. This is not a professional video by any means, but I just wanted to ask them a couple of questions about their experiences with the peer advocate program or why they think bystander intervention is important to LGBTQ youth specifically, not just to all people in general. And if the audio does not work on this, then it will be sent out to you, and you'll be able to see the link, I believe, anyway. I'm not sure if Kat's going to send that out either way. So we'll just test this out. I'm going to mute my phone so you don't hear it reflected back. Or no, I'll mute. Let me see. Yeah, I'm going to mute my phone. And Kat, will you let me know if it's not working?
I think we may have to have it play through your phone, but you can try starting it with your phone line muted if you want.
Okay. Is the volume?
Yep, we can hear it.
I don't know.
Okay, I know that there were some volume issues on some people's, but those are two peer advocates. They went through the first session, and then they both helped facilitate several others since then. So I just wanted to chat with them and share some of their experiences with you and what they got out of this program. Is there any questions about that? Or any questions, I guess this is a good time to open it up to any questions at all.
Yeah, Erin, we had a couple of questions queued up. You had, I think, had seen part of this question before, but someone had asked if you could share an experience where you've inspired a young leader that's full of passionate fire for social justice while speaking to the complexity of intervention, personal safety, et cetera. I still want someone or youth to feel excited about intervening.
Sure. An experience where I have inspired someone who is passionate about social justice. Okay. I will try to answer that question with all of the aspects of the question. Well, one example is one of the youth in the video that I just showed. Actually, I did both of them, but specifically Ash. Came when I got here and I came to this place and started doing sexual assault prevention, she'd been really involved in a lot of the prevention efforts that had happened here prior to me getting here. And I would have described her as maybe a little jaded. And the reason for that being that she didn't feel like she had the power to change any of the situations that were happening. And I would say that she was pretty passionate and is pretty passionate about social justice and pretty familiar. Unlike, you know, some of the youth that I work with, not all of them are super familiar with social justice issues or feeling like really on fire about making change or, you know, explaining things to people or educating or any of those things. And I would say that she is someone I would describe as on fire about those things in general. But at the time that I met her and the time that we started doing this, she had lost a lot of that passion and become pretty sure that nothing really was fair and nothing really worked. And what was the point anyway? Because nothing was going to change and nothing was going to end up any differently than she'd always experienced them. And she had a lot of good reasons to believe all of that. So this program for her, you know, she became one of my, I'd say, best facilitators and really amazing leaders because she wanted to do something. You know, she wanted to take action. So when I came to her and said, hey, I'm creating this, and I came to her before having created any of it. So I went to her and said, I'm about to do this, and I want your opinion, and I want your support, and I want your help. I want to make sure that it's really going to be relevant and helpful to youth. And she came up with a lot of the questions, you know, that we answered. So she talked in the video about what to do when someone discloses to you. And that's not something that I've heard typically in bystander intervention programs. There's not usually, from my experience anyway, and I have limited experience as well, but I haven't heard a lot about what to do after a disclosure happens. And that's something that she really wanted to know what to do about because, as she mentioned, her prior experience with that, her reaction was not necessarily helpful. You know, I think most of us feel really angry and really upset when we find out that something has happened to someone that we love. And if you feel powerless or you feel like there's nothing to tell them as far as help or next steps or support, it feels really bad. And she just came in a place of like, well, what do we do in this situation? And that's what she was most interested in. She got the full range of training, and she was really interested and passionate about all of the other aspects, but she wanted to know what to do about disclosure. So she helped me create cards, like peer advocate cards, that had phone numbers that has the OASIS emergency line. We have a 24-hour emergency line. It has that phone number on it. It has the Sexual Assault Center's phone number on it, the local. And it has, I don't remember what else we put on there now. I have them in my office, but it has the Trevor hotline, or I believe that's what we put on there, and that's specific for LGBT youth. or I think people in general. So we put that, and then we put some of the principles of bystander intervention on the other side. So some of the things you can do, just like a quick, I think we have the C on there, the safe, early, and effective, and the OASIS logo. And when she facilitates this training, she gets to pass these cards out. She gets to say, here's something you can do if someone discloses to you or if you're experiencing anything. Here's some numbers you can call. Here's some steps you can take. So that was just, I mean, I don't know if that really answers the full question, but I would say that she has come to life in a lot of ways since doing this and has been really passionate about facilitating it, has been passionate about, you know, talking to other youth about it, about really using the skills that she's learned. Seth, do you have any examples you want to share of that?
I think that was a great example, Erin. There's a couple pieces that I just want to throw out there, too, that Erin touched on. Two I words. One is incentives, and one is kind of initiative. So Ash is somebody who, I mean, she's probably, and I think she'd be great with us sharing this, has been coming to OASIS for about 5 or 6 years. And she constantly is taking the initiative to learn more and to engage other youth in learning more. That's just the kind of person that she is. But if you could find people to be leaders who do have that kind of initiative, and then also, what is the incentive for them? So as part of our youth adult partnership, we pay youth $25 an hour if they go out and speak for our speakers bureau, or if they go out into the community and train other students around these kind of issues. And that's our way of building into our budget a recognition of that youth's time and skills and experience. That, I mean, frankly, we wouldn't have a program like this if it were not for youth like Ash and Raphael who spoke. And so thinking about your own program and what kind of infrastructure will you have in place to give people incentives, whether those are free or low budget, or if you can start building into your budget something a little bit more significant like a gift card or payment for time for people who are co-facilitating.
Thanks, Erin. I think you guys really addressed that question really well. The only other question we had was just a clarifying question, the Step Up program. Is that out of the University of Arizona, Erin? Is that the program that you were referencing?
Yeah.
Okay. Because we found out the website is stepupprogram.org instead of just stepup.org. And I did send that to everyone in the chat, and we'll make sure we fix that in the slides before they get posted. But just want to make sure I wasn't giving someone the web address for the wrong program if that wasn't the one that you were talking about.
It's also on the handout, and I believe the full URL is on the handout.
Oh, great. And, Erin, do you want to just share with everybody a quick snip about what will be in that handout they'll be getting in that email after the webinar?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we have three attachments in the handout. And it's sexual assault bystander training curriculum development template. That's pretty long, wordy handout. But it's just each session that I created. So it's I have 4 sessions that I do with youth, and you can adapt this to whoever, you know, however much time you have. But it has what's in each of those sessions. So, for instance, session 1, the foundations, we talk about what is sexual assault. We came up with a mission statement. We talk about root causes. You know, so on and so forth. So we have a consent activity, and we have links to consent activities for people to find. In sessions 2 and 3, we talked about the 5 steps of intervening and how to do that, and that references stepup.org, stepprogram.org. And then session 4, we bring scenarios and create scenarios. So it just has an outline of each of the sessions that I give to youth. And then we have an attachment that is about needs assessment and how to create a needs assessment. And we have an attachment that's the 5 steps to bystander intervention. So it's just the sort of brief overview of noticing the event, what are the challenges, what are the easy things about that, interpreting it, assuming responsibility, having the skills to intervene, and taking action. So it just breaks down each one of those a little more in depth. So those are the three things
that
we'll get.
That will be great. And that will be coming. It'll be one PDF. It will be on that email that gives you your training hour certification. And also, you'll see in the slide, you've got the presenter's contact information. And once again, we will make the slides available within a week on our website. So you can go back and look at these. I think those are all the questions we have time to answer for today. I just really want to thank Erin and Seth for this wonderful webinar and for being so great and sharing so much great information. And hope that you all can join us on our next web conference.
And people can really email me if they have any other specific questions. I'm happy to answer.
Great. Thanks for that offer, Erin.
Yeah,
okay, well, everyone have a great day.
Thank you. Please stand by.